Welcome to Season 9, Episode 42 of the Ubuntu Podcast. In this episode, we're going to be discussing lapdo.org. We'll also have some command line love and go over your feedback. I'm Joe, and joining me this week are Alan.
Hello, hello.
Mark.
Hello.
And Martin.
Hola.
So, it's good to be back. it's been a long week.
You made time for us then, Joe, in your busy schedule.
It's much appreciated that you could join us. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
Yes. So, what have you been up to this week, Mark?
I went to PHP Oxford, which is a PHP user group in Oxford, which I recently discovered, having lived here for a number of years. And I saw Lorna Mitchell doing a talk about webhooks.
What are webhooks, Mark?
Webhooks.
What is a Lorna Mitchell, Mark?
Lorna Mitchell, you may know if you've ever been to OCCamp. Yes. She's a good talker does lots of PHP stuff. And webhooks are kind of like an API in reverse. So instead of having, instead of publishing an API from your website, like GitHub or whatever, you allow people to say, when something happens, send a piece of data to this URL in my system. So rather than your system calling their API, they send you something when they've got something for you, basically. So rather than, it means that you have less polling going on and more just data being sent when it's needed. Mm. And it's quite clever.
That sounds much less fun than I had in my head. When you said it was an API in reverse, I thought it was an IPA and I immediately thought beer.
Sounds like fun. What about you, Martin? What have you been up to?
I went to Bad Hack and learned about 3D printing.
What did you learn about 3D printing?
Everything imaginable.
That's a lot of things.
Yeah, so Bad Hack. I live in the district of Basingstoke and Deane, so that's where the BAD comes from in the hack, and this is the emerging Basingstoke and Deane makerspace. And I found out there's a local cottage industry called 3D Discover, who are a 3D printing company. And you can send them your designs or work with them and create a design and they will print it for you. And the guy that runs the company brought in two of his 3D printers and gave us the full backstory on 3D printing and let us all have a play and printed stuff and played with the modelling tools and learned about the different materials. And it was really good because I kind of know what 3D printing is, but to actually get to do it and look at all the equipment and have a play was really interesting, really useful.
You said this was like a collective or company. Is this like a collective version of Shapeways where you send your 3D thing and you get back an actual thing in the post?
He does make physical things, but it's not a web service where you log in and upload your design. It's more a consultative service. So if you've got a design, he can print it. Or if you need something designing from scratch, he can do that as well. So he does a range of things, ranging from some sort of obvious things like architects who want scale models of their creations to use for show and tell in their pitches. He'll create those. Because invariably the architects have the 3D data already. It just needs putting into the appropriate tools and then printing. And even stuff like for dentists, for making orthodontic guides and all sorts of materials. He said that the dentistry industry is one of the largest users of 3D printing.
You can 3D print teeth?
No, but more the braces and things like that. So things like where pilot holes should go for, surgical procedures and stuff like this.
Any Linux to be seen anywhere, or was it all Windows?
Yes, it was. There was an awful lot of Windows. I'm not sure if any of the guys are going to be listening to this.
Sure.
Yeah, I intend to. So there was an awareness of open source generally. But yes, I was the only person there who was full-time Linux and open source, but definitely the right group of people to show some of the stuff, that's available and to present some of the alternatives and options.
When's the next Bad Hack? You mentioned it in the previous episode. For those people who are goldfish memories, when is it?
It is December the 13th, so that's Tuesday, December the 13th. There'll be every other Tuesday from that date onwards, and I think the website is basingstokemakerspace.org.uk.
Just realised how useless it was me saying that, given this episode.
It was 2 days ago.
Right, so the next one will be just like January the 10th, I think, then the next one.
Yeah, let's just forget that ever happened.
Yeah. Move on.
So we may have mentioned that recently Martin and I went to Ubicon Europe in Essen in Germany. And while there, we met Ralph Hamm, who was an awesome dude from labdo.org, which is a global humanitarian social network who want to make our planet better by a better place by providing those with underdeveloped regions with a chance at better education. By our man, that all
that's
sounded
a long sentence.
Terrible. I'm going to start that again, and I will volunteer to edit that bit out.
Don't read it.
It's a bit like being on Linux Luddites, this.
This is a first.
So we may have mentioned once or twice that myself and Martin went to Ubicon Europe in Essen. And while there, we bumped into a chap called Ralph Hamm from labdo.org. Smashing guy who works on a project to deliver computers to people who need them around the world, mostly in developed nations, but could be anywhere. We recorded a little interview with him, which we'll hear now.
We're here with Martin at Ubicon in Essen in Germany, and we're joined by Ralph Hamm from the LabDo project. Hello, Ralph. How are
Hello.
You?
Hello.
So tell us about LabDo. How did you get started? What does LabDo do?
LabDo collects unused computers and sanitizes them and installs educational software and content for children and schools all over the world.
And whereabouts are you based, and what's your reach?
My personal base is Germany. I'm doing this job for LabDo.org. in Germany, and the project itself started in California, 2010, and students at the University of California thought about a way to bring education to undeveloped countries.
And is it the case that you're just taking laptops that, you know, corporates have got rid of and end users have got rid of, and you know, en masse reflashing Linux on them? What do you do with a machine that's been donated to you?
When we get a laptop donated, we check that all the data is removed securely. Companies very often know how to do that. Private persons are not aware of a good solution, so we do it for them. Then we sanitize the laptop, repair it if needed, and then we install free software like Lubuntu, educational software, and most of all, educational content, because the schools abroad, they have no chance to access to internet.
So when you install an Ubuntu flavor on the laptop, do you install it in OEM mode so they turn it on and set up a user account, or is it all set up, ready to go with a predefined account?
It is everything preset on the machine. We have, for the installation, for an easier installation, we have images for cloning. So you can install a laptop within a few minutes. When you start the software, we have a three-level concept. There is a teacher account, there is a student account, and the guest account.
And so when you have gone through the process of flashing these machines, obviously you're based in Germany and your target audience are all around the world. How do you get your hardware shipped out to those people?
The basic idea of the project is to do all this help and contribution with a very poor impact on the pollution. So we don't want to produce any CO2 in addition. We don't want to spend money, at least as less money as possible. And so we ask travelers when they go abroad for holidays or for business to take one or two laptops in their suitcase. Or very often we have goods shipped in a container and then there is space left and companies offer us a free delivery. And by that way we transported close to 9,000 devices already.
Oh. And is that from your section of Labdo? Because you said there was an American version as well. Is that all that global cooperative?
You can see all the figures online on our homepage. So we are the international Labdo community. Collected about 8,700 laptops so far. The German-speaking countries, Austria, Switzerland, and Germany, they do a large part of this contribution. But the idea of Labdo is that everybody can help everybody using our portal, our web portal, and can see where's the demand. So, for instance, if there is a project in Uganda and someone is leaving from New York, he can contact the helpers in New York, gets a laptop and brings it to Uganda, as well as if he starts from Rome or from Madrid.
So is it entirely distributed? You project manage, but there are people spread out and they have, you know, a few laptops in their house. Is that how it works? How would it typically work, the life cycle of a laptop that comes in and goes out?
We have a student with a one-room apartment and he has in a shelf some laptops to give away. We have some helpers having a garage or a room, which is, of course, you can load more laptops to such a room, but it's it depends on your possibility. If you have the space, you can offer it. Usually we have a local network. Some is the person to install the laptops, another one has maybe the contacts to press or to companies. So we encourage our helpers to get into a hub, a team, mm-hmm. and then it's easier for everybody in the team. You can work in an ideal way.
For the number of machines that have gone out, do you keep any track of how many of them are continued to be in use, or what state they're in when they've gone?
When you visit our portal, labdo.org, you will see all projects. Every laptop is tagged. Every laptop has got an ID. Even when we have the email address of the donor, he gets a link and he can follow up where the laptop is. So you can see at each time where is which machine, and even the status when it's broken, it will be documented. And then we look for a spare laptop, return the broken one to Europe or the States for recycling. So it's not only to bring education to the countries, but also to avoid e-waste abroad.
That's brilliant. So if you donate a laptop or many laptops, you can actually see where they ended up and how they were being used.
Yeah. There's even a scrapbook, sometimes videos. Sometimes we get videos from it. So if you're lucky, not all the time, but if you're lucky, you can see your laptop being used in Africa or Nepal.
Wow. It sounds like open source in a lot of ways, in that you can choose to contribute in different ways to this effort. If you've got old computers, you could donate those. Or you could operate as a laptop refurbisher and installer, or you could be one of the companies that sponsors couriering, or as an individual, if you're visiting an appropriate country, you could take one with you.
Exactly. Very good summarize. Okay. What are we doing?
Let's suppose I am going to be traveling to Malawi. How would I contact Labdo to say I should take a laptop or two laptops with me?
You should filter our open projects. So you ask for, show me all projects in Malawi, show me the open projects. And then there is a link. And when you follow this link to a project in Malawi, you will see the person to contact. You will see the hub in charge for that. So all our information are online, because otherwise we could not manage the processes worldwide. Or another way is, if you go there and if you want to give the laptops to a certain village school, which is not part of our project, you can start a request. You can send a request sheet to a Labdo hub. Then we put this in our database. It is published on our website. And from that moment, the laptops can start to roll.
So you mentioned before we started talking that you were looking for reaching out outside of Germany to maybe the UK and other places for people to get involved in this kind of thing. And is it, like as Martin said, is it you're just looking for people who just want to do any of these tasks? It's not like a new organization to create. It's the workers as such.
Yeah, we would like to encourage a person who like our idea to start either to contribute as a donor or a traveler, or to start a hub in their region. So they start to collect from companies or private persons laptop donations, start to work technically on those laptops. But that has to be decided by the individual helper. We cannot demand help us. We can just say, this is our idea, this is our concept, and so many people like us. So the project doubled every year last year. And so I'm very optimistic that this idea will be, there will be positive reactions in other countries too.
So we've talked about a couple of African countries there by way of example. What other countries are benefiting from this, and are there any Western countries taking donations for educational computers?
We don't have to go far. When you look for Germany, we have this refugee situation here the last 2 years. So about 20% of the computer donations from Germany stay in Germany and are given to schools when they have to do extra training for young pupils coming from abroad, or we give it to initiatives organizing German language courses, so you don't have to go far. But besides that, the typical way is from developed countries to the developing countries.
Yeah.
So the States, Europe, Japan are usually the companies collecting the laptops, and then Asia, Africa, Middle South America, they are the countries receiving the laptops. But there are sometimes even within a country like Mexico, we have helpers in Mexico City collecting laptops and giving them to the rural area of Mexico. So sometimes it's even within a country.
Yeah. And what are the questions I'm sure some people listening to this will wonder is, the people who are transporting the laptops in their cases, are there any issues or challenges for them in terms of customs declarations and so on when they're transporting things?
It depends on the amount of laptops you're carrying. When you have one or two, it doesn't do any... you don't have any problems. But if you come with a box of 20 or 30, they will ask. Typically, we have supporting letters from the receiver, from a bishop, from a major, from our organization. So usually you can solve it in advance. And some countries are very open to receive computer donations like that. They are very much aware of the effect of open source software. And some are very limited, restricted, like Brazil or other countries. It's nearly impossible to get computers in those countries. But we can when we get a request, then we discuss with the traveler about the situation. And another thing he should check is with his flight company, because some rules have changed. The IATA rules were very open, up to 100 watt hours, which is more or less every laptop battery is below that limitation. But because there were so many fire caused by lithium ion batteries, they started to make it more restrict. So you should contact your travel agency or flight company, and they will tell you if it's no problem to transport a laptop. Some say leave the battery at home, and some say laptops in the suitcase, battery in the hand luggage.
Right. What you talked about Ubuntu being the choice. I guess that's because some of the laptops you're getting are slightly older, lower spec, and to try and keep the memory and footprint down. What other software actually goes on there above Ubuntu?
We install, beside Ubuntu, we install XFCE4 as a desktop, as an additional desktop, because this desktop has some advantages for visually impaired users. We use the Ubuntu bundle. We use about 40-50 additional programs, which makes sense, like SOVAR to keep offline wikis stored locally, and of course all the Office, LibreOffice, and Firefox and the other software packages were also installed. And we add a lot of educational content, which is becoming more and more important. There is an English course pre-installed, everything. We look for open educational resources. And then we add offline wikis, Wikipedia for schools. Rachel, for instance, very good collection. And this is pre-installed and then transported and given to the schools.
That's amazing. If people wanted to get involved, people are excited about this and have some time, what would they do to get started?
The best way is to visit our homepage, and then you can send an email to contact@letdo.org, or if you're in Germany, you can send letdo-dach@letdo.org. But it's our homepage offers various ways to get in contact with us, and then we can inform this interested or potential helper how he can get in contact either with local helpers, which are already in our network, or if it's an area with no helpers so far, then we help him to set up a hub or just a local network.
Brilliant. So I've got about half a dozen old computers that I've been wondering what I'm going to do with, and I think I found out what I'm going to do with them now. But one of my questions is, I have two relatively new old desktop computers as opposed to laptops. Are you interested in desktops or is it just laptops?
Partially. It depends where the laptops are located, when the desktops are located. When you have a need, an open project close to your area, then it makes sense to sanitize PCs. And then you can give it to a school or refugee project or orphan houses in your area, because the problem is a desktop will not fit in a suitcase.
Yeah, okay. So, but that you can find a way to use those desktop computers.
Definitely.
In your projects.
Yeah.
Right, excellent. Yeah, well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us, Ralph. And I hope that our listeners, as we're approaching Christmas, start thinking about how they could spread a little bit of love using open source and your organization to do it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brilliant.
And now it's time for command line love. So recently I needed to convert thousands of 7-zip archives to zip archives, and I found a tool, actually called a tool, which made this very simple.
So why did you need to do this?
Yeah, what kind of lunatic uses 7-zip?
What kind of lunatic stops using 7-zip and converts everything to zip instead?
There are reasons why I needed to convert lots of 7-zip archives to zip archives. Let's just
leave Your it Honor.
That, shall we?
Okay, let's so, yes. leave that unsaid.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, right, okay, I could write a shell script to do this. But more and more these days, I think to myself, somebody will have already done this. And I went searching, and there is. There's a tool, and it's called Atool, A-T-O-O-L. And it's a script for managing archives of various types. And one of its features is you can take an archive and repack it in a different format. So I needed to go from 7-zip to zip. So I apt install atool and p7-zip hyphen full, because I needed the p7-zip for this. And then I just ran atool tac re tac tac format equals zip. *.7z, and that was in the directory full of all of my 7z archives, and it just went whoosh and turned all thousands of them into zip files, and took about 10 or 15 minutes to do, and that was it. Interestingly, the disk space requirements for the 7-zip archives were around 700 meg, and when they were zip files, it was 4 gig.
Well, this is exactly why I was wondering why the hell you did this.
Because I had some software that could only speak zip.
Oh, I see.
And I needed the files in zip format.
Presumably it needs a fair bit of disk space and or RAM to do this, because it must have to unpack them first and then repack them.
Yeah, it does. It effectively un-7Z's them, and in this case un-7Z's them and then zips them. I've got a machine here with, 32 gigs of RAM and an i7 i7 something and NVMe PCI Express hard drives. So consequently, it didn't break a sweat.
Oh, good.
It didn't take very long.
But that's your beast of a nuck thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the Skull Canyon nuck, yeah. Yeah, but it's a great utility, and it's got a number of different archive conversion and manipulation utilities built in.
Does the thing call out to other tools to do it, or does it all yes. built in and it does it? Okay.
Yeah, it calls out. So it's basically a shell script that wraps a number of other archiving tools. So instead of me writing a shell script, somebody's written one, packaged it, it's in the archive, and you can just install it and do stuff.
Sweet. Nice. That's awesome. Let's hear from Laura.
We love getting your feedback, so please send it to us. Even the pointlessly mean stuff makes us laugh. If it's short, tweet us on @UbuntuPodcast. If it's less short, but please no essays, email us on show@UbuntuPodcast.org. If you'd like to discuss some of the things we talk about with other listeners, post on our shiny new subreddit at reddit.com/r/UbuntuPodcast. Or you can just leave a comment on the relevant show notes on our website, ubuntupodcast.org.
And now it's time for some of your lovely feedback that Laura was just telling us about. First up, we've got Patrick Buller, who emailed us at show@ubuntupodcast.org.
Wanted to make a small correction about Udo. You said it was formerly OpenCRM when it was actually OpenERP. Otherwise, great show and thanks for the laughs.
Yes, that was my slip of the tongue. Sorry about that. Thank you for spotting that, Patrick.
Chris Guiver left us a comment on our Google Plus page.
Alan Pope, now you tell me about a PrimeOS flaw. I could have used that in 84-85 when I used PrimeOS at uni.
Woohoo.
Daniel posted a comment on our website.
I'm really disappointed in the Lux vulnerability discussion. Did you all forget to mention how the encryption itself wasn't compromised, and a shell at boot really does nothing but modify the /boot contents, and other partitions are not encrypted? I would like Martin to explain this in full detail.
Yeah, Martin, go on.
Yeah, come on, Martin. I know. Slacker.
Yeah, I know. So Martin has posted the impact section from the CVE in reply to Daniel's comment on our website. And I also go on to explain why I feel that there is no adequate mitigation to someone having physical access to your server, because one or more of the InfoSec CIA triads, that's confidentiality, integrity, or availability, can no longer be assured. So if you go to our website, you can see Daniel's question in full, you can see my reply, and Daniel has posted some follow-up, and maybe you want to join in that conversation and help defend my honour. Thank you. Martin Hennessy emailed us.
It's a long one. Settle down. Hello, everyone. I thought I'd chime in with my NextDoc experience. The plastic this thing is made out of is really cheap, and the pristine white surface scuffs pretty easily. However, given the price, that is an observation, not a complaint. The keyboard is a great size, at least in my opinion, and though a little mushy, it's serviceable. I find the trackpad near unusable, but the reason for this is probably because the first trackpad I ever used was made by Apple. My wife has a MacBook Air and bought a Magic trackpad for an iMac I used to own. I carry a small USB mouse to avoid using it, but in truth, I try to depend on the keyboard as much as possible, and so I've installed Qt Browser. It's ace. That's Qute Browser. I agree with Martin that the keyboard would be better if it didn't rely on Bluetooth. I'm connected to a Pi running the distro that shall not be named, and use the Bluetooth CTL tool to pair, trust, and connect. I have a one-line shell script file on my desktop that echoes the connect command to Bluetooth CTL and runs on startup, allowing me to connect easily. Proper nerd. I've chosen to keep the script on my desktop because not infrequently something goes amiss and I use the USB mouse to switch Pi Bluetooth on and off again. I think you probably mean off and on again, but okay. Via the GUI, and then double-click the script to reconnect the keyboard. Even this has failed on one occasion, and I had to find a wired keyboard, launch Bluetooth CTL, forget the device, and then re-add it.
Oh, Linux.
Epic, yes. Year of the Linux desktop. He goes on. Despite the Bluetooth woes, I still find the Pi Mate NextDoc combination to be really workable and portable. I haven't explored audio, microphone, or webcam yet, as I haven't needed them. Finally, I'm really satisfied with the battery. I switched this thing on for 4 hours ago, and I've been using it constantly since. Admittedly, only browsing, text editing, and some general GUI and terminal-based file management stuff, but it's nice not to have to find somewhere to plug it in. Awesome email. Thank you so much for that feedback, Martin.
Yeah, that was great. And Peter Green emailed us.
I'm not sure if you take requests, but I would love to hear your thoughts on the Snoopers Charter, given its incredibly wide range, particularly on the part that allows the government to force backdoors in encryption. Is Ubuntu developed in the UK, as I believe it is? And if so, how vulnerable is it to the Prime Minister's madness?
Yeah, I see what he did there.
So yes, you would have heard our initial thoughts on this, well, several shows ago and in the last show, and you'll be hearing a lot more from us on it, I am sure.
Mm.
But as for whether Ubuntu could be backdoored, surely not, because the code's out there, someone would find it, and they wouldn't get away with it.
Yeah, all of that Ubuntu stuff that you install on your desktops and servers is in the open, so you would see if it got backdoored or not.
Yeah, and then people would just stop using it and start using something which wasn't backdoored. So
I watched an excellent video from DEFCON 21 or 22 maybe, which was, we'll put in the show notes, I'll add it, and it talked about all the ways in which you can mess up. He didn't call it mess up, it's NSFW, but he talked about all the ways in which you could mess up your life if you're trying to be secure and trying to be safe, and even whether Ubuntu is or isn't compromised, or whether any other distro is or isn't compromised, there are numerous ways that they or the man can get you, and it's worth a watch because it really enlightens you on like the myriad of ways that actually you're vulnerable to attack. So yeah, we'll add that in, and let's move on.
Well, that's all for episode 42. They'll all be back next week when they'll have more news, comment, and discussion. And with any luck, a Christmas panto. What do you reckon, guys? Stunned silence.
God. Will we really? Oh, my gosh. Come back, Tony. All is forgiven.
Yes, next week is the penultimate show of the season.
Yes.
Might be the penultimate show ever.
Ever, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Might be.
Yeah, we have to figure that out in February next year. We always do that. Don't panic. We always have a break.
We don't need to email us asking if we're coming back. We'll tell you.
It's not you, it's us.
I'm going to automate that.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
See you later. Stop.